In December of last year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced that it would be taking the Western Great Lakes wolf off of the endangered species list. In April, Governor Walker signed into law a bill that directed the Department of Natural Resources to create a wolf hunt structure and quota system, and the public has weighed in. Now, the DNR has come up with some proposals, and the final recommendations on this year's wolf hunt will come in July when the Natural Resources Board meets. There's been a long simmering debate over wolves in Wisconsin. Some hunters want farmers want to limit their numbers to hold back on the depredation of cattle and hunting dogs, while some environmental groups and conservation groups say wolves need to be protected because they were nearly wiped off of our landscape just 50 years ago. So now it's up to the DNR and the Natural Resources Board to try and strike a balance. And we talk about how that can happen this hour on the West Side Outside. I'm Rich Kramer, and I'm joined by the outdoor guys who are Dave Carlson. Dave is the host of syndicated TV program Northland Adventures, and good to have you back here, Dave.
Good to be back. Thanks for having us, always.
Always. And Joe Knight, he's the other outdoor guy. He is the outdoor editor for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. Thanks for stopping by, Joe.
Glad to be here.
And I'm pleased to welcome our featured guest this hour. We welcome Dave Klassen. Dave is a veterinarian at the Community Pet Hospital in Amory, and he's also the chair of the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board, and that's a citizen panel that advises the DNR. Dave Klassen, thanks for joining us this evening as well.
My pleasure.
And so the discussion tonight will focus on wolves, but we'll also get into some other things, namely the effort to ban lead shot and hunting, not just waterfalls, which you already can or have to use steel shot for, but in other things, even deer hunting. And we'll also talk some about sand mining's impacts. There's been some recent spills from sand mines in the area that have affected some wetlands and some streams and some rivers. And we'll also take a look at Dave Carlson's new book titled A Fish Gift and Sketches from Northland Adventures. But first we talk wolves, and I want to hear from listeners. What do you think of the proposed Wisconsin wolf hunt? Do you think that these animals should be protected? Are there too many of them? Are you a farmer or a hunter who's lost livestock or a hunting dog? Give us a call, 800-228-5615. The number again is 800-228-5615. You can also post a question or a comment on the West Side Facebook page. And we'll start out with Dave Klassen. The DNR proposed harvest quotas total between 142 and 233 wolves. There has been a number of public hearings since then. What kind of impact have these meetings had, and what do you think the final quota will look like?
You know, I think the meetings, there's certainly a lot of pressure on the department from all sides, and it's going to be very difficult for the department. The legislature, by being as prescriptive as they were with this season, have not left a lot of room to manage the wolf in a sustainable way, and I think that is a concern for all of us.
What do you mean prescriptive? They laid out how many needed to be taken, or
they have laid out the length of the season, the methods of the take, the hunting hours, basically all of that type of thing, and that makes it a little more difficult for the DNR to actually regulate what goes on.
All right, so the wolf hunt, we've been running stories all day from the wolf hunt is around, or the wolf population, that is, in Wisconsin, is up to, at the high end, is 880 wolves. Is that correct?
I believe that's probably the current figure that's being used, yes.
Okay, and so is that too many, I guess, is a basic question.
I think that depends on how you look at it and whether or not I think what's important here to keep in mind is that we do need to do something about depredation, and we have needed to have the ability to do lethal control and depredation for a long time. And so that part is something that we really need to uh, take take into consideration, and that should be a large share of our focus, besides giving an opportunity for some recreational harvest.
Dave Carlson here. Dean Bortz had a column in his most recent Wisconsin Outdoor News that he thought the count was closer to 2,000 and that the DNR is actually saying their estimate is at the low end. And, you know, when you see things like that, what does it do for the whole debate?
Well, you know, it's interesting that we're accused of overcounting deer and undercounting wolves, and that that is anytime you start to count animals, there's always some room. But we have to go with what we've been doing, and hope that we're as accurately. I would tell you that the DNR is doing the best job they can do as far as counting, and I do not believe that there is any way that they are going to either minimize or exaggerate the count.
Now, for a layman like me, how do they count the wolves? Is it an aerial count, or is it through taking operations, or how is that done?
They do aerial surveys, and then they also do tracking surveys, where we have all of our fur bearer, all of our biologists and other workers make note of tracks that they see here and there, road kills, that type of thing. And then there's an extensive network of citizen monitors that go out and count the tracks. And so between the aerial surveys and what's being seen for tracks, that's pretty much what the counts are based on.
Bill Van Der Zorn told me at the Spooner meeting it boils down to basically reduction, and the issue is how far and how fast. If you were testifying as a citizen now, not the Natural Resources Board chair, what would you recommend?
I would recommend being somewhat cautious about this. I've spent a little time studying this, and if you look at our other fur bearers, if you look at otter, fisher, bobcat, we try to do the best job that we can do, but there's been a history back into the middle 90s of our hunters and trappers exceeding our quota for those animals, and we haven't been particularly effective in doing much about that. The current situation is that fisheries right now, I believe, are 30% under our population goal. Otters are like 21 or 23% under, and bobcats, depending on what you want to use for a recommended population, somewhere between 2 and 3,000, they're 14 to 43% under. So it's really hard to maintain a fur bearer level at a given level. And so as we move forward, the smaller that number is for a goal, the more precise we have to be, or we run the risk of relisting.
Hmm. Dave, Joe Knight here. Question,
yep.
In your quota or your permanent quotas, you're assuming a success level of hunters of about 20%. Is that right? That's kind of like turkey hunting. And I'm wondering where you got that, and if I suspect I can find an old trapper where if I want to trap a wolf, I can have about 95% chance if we go to the right place in northern Wisconsin. Are you worried that may lead to an overharvest?
Well, if we set the quotas and the ability is there to close the season when we get to that quota.
Okay. Is that like you do with the ducks and the or geese in the external zone, but do you think you'll get the same level of compliance with wolf hunters? Won't the tendency to be to go where most of the wolves are to begin with? And
well,
and
the quotas are going to vary. The one thing that's really important about this is the spatial distribution of the harvest. In other words, what percentage of wolves are going to be allowed to be harvested in given areas? And it's really important that a smaller percentage of the pack be harvested in kind of the core area, because that needs to serve as a source population for the rest of the state. And if you look at the models that are done on this, as you get close to 350 wolves, if that is indeed the goal, it is going to be difficult to sustain that if the harvest in that core area gets over 10%. In fact, the models that are being run now, the only way that they look sustainable is that we're counting, or the models take into consideration the fact that wolves are going to come here from both Minnesota and Michigan, and that gives the appearance of stability. But in reality, with that type of numbers, we may have trouble maintaining that 350.
Bill, Dave, you're a bird hunter and a dog owner, hunting dog owner. Bear season will be closed when the trapping and hunting seasons begin for wolves. What would you recommend to bird hunters with dogs as they go afield into some of these very same areas that wolves are being trapped?
You know, I have I certainly have some concerns about that because having this new dog, she has wormed her way into everybody's hearts, and I would hate to see anything happen to her. On the other hand, I would tell you that the traps that are being proposed are 7 inches or less, and those are already legal for coyotes. So a certain amount of that is already out there. So I don't know. I think that's going to remain to be seen. I know that should my dog get trapped in one of those, I'd not be a happy camper.
Mm. With that, I'd like to go to the phones. We are going to go to Mondovi now, and we've got Julia, on the phone. Julia, you're on the air. Thank you so much for calling. What's your comment or question?
Hi, good program. Well, my question is, not really question, but comment. We have 120 acres. It's very heavily wooded, and we have our home on the middle 40. And we don't have wolves, per se. I've never sighted any, but we do have a lot of coyotes, and we now have a good population of bear. And I think what people need to understand, too, is that when you get overpopulated with any one type of wildlife, some of the other wildlife will suffer dramatically. I mean, we have also wild turkeys, and we're able to watch a lot of the wildlife because we are on the middle 40. And a lot of times what we're experiencing right now is a heavy population of coyotes, and it's downed our population of turkeys dramatically. Just watching the hens in the spring with their young chicks and then disappearing, and actually seeing a coyote some years ago just eating them about 25 feet away from my house. Mm. And other bird, like the pheasants and the grouse that we're trying to get their populations back up. But, it's detrimental, I think, to the whole ecosystem that we have to sometimes step in and balance that out so no one gets the upper hand too much. So.
All right. Julia, thanks so much for the call. And we need to step in, is what Julia is saying. Dave Clausen, do you agree?
Well, it's really interesting. I'm certainly a pheasant hunter. I'm also a turkey hunter. And I kind of look forward to having the coyotes around here because they kill the foxes, and the fox is a more efficient predator on the pheasants. So I'll take a few more coyotes if it means more pheasants for me. So all of this thing, all the Leopold goes back to the basic premise: when you pull on one thing, you find out how many other things it's connected to, and it's kind of an ebb and flow type of thing, and sometimes the species is up, sometimes it's down, and to a certain extent, we do influence that, but a lot of what goes on has to do with the different populations and how they're interacting with each other, and if you get too many of something, sometimes some disease comes along and wipes them out, or there that seems like it has a way of working out.
All the people that are interested in hunting wolves with firearms, they certainly are going to find out how difficult it is to spot them, let alone shoot them. That's according to even some of the strongest advocates for a wolf hunting season. And the interest may wane.
I don't know if the interest will wane. It is interesting from an economic standpoint. We have a lot of wolves right now, and we have a lot of room for we've got a fairly large margin of error. But if you get down, as we get down to 350, it's pretty well, you can use a figure. The model is really complicated. You can use a figure of somewhere between 23 and 28% harvest will start a decline in the wolf population. So if we figure, I'm just going to say 25% human-caused mortality is going to cause the population to go down. And we have about 10%. It's going to look like about 10% of the wolf population is going to be taken by depredation management. In other words, wolves that have been preying on farm animals and that type of thing. That looks like it's going to be about 10%. There's about another 6% that history has shown us back quite a few years that are going to be shot illegally during deer season or whatever. And another 3% or so of other human-caused mortality, such as car accidents and that type of thing. So you're at 20% of the wolf population being killed by these other things, which leaves 5% left for a recreational type of harvest. And if you figure 5% times 350 comes out to 10.5 wolves, if the tribes declare half of those, that leaves 5.25 wolves for a recreational harvest. And I frankly am having a lot of trouble believing that we're going to get enough participation at that kind of a harvest level to, or harvest opportunity rather, to sell licenses and certainly to sell application permits to support the depredation. And I'm thinking as farmers start looking at that, they're probably not going to be particularly anxious to be sharing that with the $2,500 hounds.
Dave, changing subjects here a little bit, your personal crusade with banning lead, where are we?
Well, that continues to be an ongoing thing. I was talking with somebody from Fish and Wildlife here last week, and this person had been present at a presentation I gave at the Midwest Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies last June down in Iowa. And he said, you know, he said, you're right. And he said, and it's slowly moving that way. And I think it is. What we're looking for is I would like to do this in an educational manner. And I think we did a good thing in the last year by putting on these demonstrations about the effectiveness of copper ammunition as a substitute for deer hunting, and I switched to that to copper the first year this lead and venison thing came out. And you can argue that however you want, but I'm not taking a risk with my my grandchildren, because we do eat a lot of venison, and I would not switch back for anything. I found that this copper has been way more effective as far as putting the deer down on the spot, and I think that's what other people are starting to find too. And I think once the word gets out that it works better, people will go ahead and change over. And you know, it's a thing that's going to take some momentum. And I think that it, from that standpoint, that it will, they'll change just because it's better.
How much of a factor is cost, though? There's a lot of people who just get sticker shock at bullets in general. What if it costs an extra dollar or two per box or more for these copper bullets?
Actually, the last time I bought copper, lead has come up so much. I've always shot a premium bullet. And certainly you can find some cheap ammunition, but to me it's I don't shoot that much of it when I'm shooting it at deer. I'm hopefully at one shot or so, and that's such a small part of what goes into it. And like I say, the last time I looked at it, I believe that the premium lead ammunition had gone up, and the price of the copper ammunition pretty well stayed the same, and there was not that much difference. In fact, I think I did see some lead ammunition that was actually higher than the copper.
All right, Dave Clausen, Dave Carlson, and Joe Knight, stand by. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking a bit about the structured quotas of the proposed wolf hunt in Wisconsin. We're also going to talk a bit about Dave Carlson's book, A Fish Gift, and sketches from Northland Adventures, and we are also talking a little bit about sand mining and lead in bullets. So stay tuned. If you have a question or a comment for any of our guests, give us a call at 800-228-5615. You can also post your question or comment on our Westside Facebook page. We've got a caller on the line. Do hang with us. We'll be right back. This is the Westside Outside. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to the Westside Outside on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking this hour about the proposed wolf hunt in Wisconsin, what it will look like, and how many wolves might be killed. I'm joined by outdoor guys, including outdoor editor for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, Joe Knight, and host of the syndicated TV show Northland Adventures, Dave Carlson. And we're glad to welcome Dave Clausen, chair of the Natural Resources Board, to the show as well. And listeners, what do you think about the wolf hunt? Are you in favor or against it? What do you think about a lead shot in, for rifles or for shotguns? Give us a call. The number is 800-228-5615. That number again, 800-228-5615. We've got two callers on the line right now, so we'll get to them right away. This is we're going to go to Greenwood, and we've got Randy on the line. Randy, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Yes, I was wondering how the DNR come up with that we were going to have a 20% success rate when states out west, they have a 1% average or even lower, and they have extended seasons, and they still cannot meet their quotas. I'm wondering how they come up with we're going to have 20% success.
All right, thanks for that, Randy. Dave Clausen?
You know, I'm going to have to defer to our biologists on that and their research. That's the number they came up with. And I think one of the things that we don't know for sure where this will be. Most of the research that's been done on wolves has been like in Alaska and Canada and to a certain extent out west, but there's a large population, a relatively small, in comparison, population sink. I'm not exactly sure that that's the case in Wisconsin. We're in more of a compact type of area, and there is more opportunity for interaction with people. So I'm not going to, I can't tell you exactly how they got there. All I'm saying is this is what our biologists are coming up with, and I can't dispute that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Randy. And we'll go again to the phones. And this time we've got Christy on the line in Chippewa Falls. Christy, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
I had read an article, and one of the critiques of the proposal is that the wolf hunt would be during when the females are having their litters. And is that true? And aren't the females more susceptible then? And then how does the public support weigh in with that? And are there other states that have successful models? I also read that the season is so long that you'd be harvesting a wolf when its coat is fairly mangy. So why would you hunt during that time as well?
All right. Thanks a lot, Christy. Dave Clausen again.
Oh, I would say that first you have to talk to the legislature about all of that. That is certainly their proposal. I will tell you that we're not exactly sure. If you look at the research, tells us that if the breeding female from a pack is killed, the chances of that pack reproducing and producing any pups the next year is less than 50%. If both breeding animals, the male and the female, are killed, the chances of that pack producing offspring the next year is somewhere between 6 and 9%. So we don't know what's going to happen as a result of killing some of these breeding animals, because the results probably won't be visible for a couple of years, and that is not really fully taken into consideration in the population models that we're using. So to a certain extent, that's an unknown situation.
All right. Christy, thanks for the call. Joanne, you wanted to jump in?
Dave, what about that 350 population goal? That seems to be kind of written in in stone, but it was really, I was at the meeting where it was set back, was it 98 or 99, and it was really a compromise based on, as the Resources Board tends to do, based on people who had different views of how many wolves they should have, and it was sort of a minimum. The biologist said it was sort of a minimum that you could have, assuming you had free flow back and forth to Minnesota for a population. I know we know quite a bit more about wolves now, and we've had some modeling down at UW-Madison that says puts the sustainable number more in the neighborhood of 600 for the large forest blocks we have. And do you have any concerns? You mentioned once you get down to 350, you have some potential for sending the population in a little bit of a tailspin if you're shooting the wrong wolves.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, I mentioned earlier before, the smaller your target is, the less room for error that you have. And I think if we're going to be able to maintain some type of a recreational hunt, that eventually that number is probably going to end up a little higher. But that being said, I expect that this first year is kind of set up Natural Resource Department was kind of under orders to set up emergency rules, get this thing going by this year. We're going to learn quite a bit this year, and I'm assuming that the wolf management plan will be revisited and that there will be probably the debate that didn't happen in the legislature may well happen over the next year or two with the rewriting of the wolf management plan and what is looked at for goals, if indeed there is any goal, or if the wolves are going to be managed as a species, and more how they fit in biologically, and at what level can they be managed and still be able to minimize the depredation. So that's going to be a huge debate over the next couple of years here, and like I say, we're going to learn a lot this fall.
What are we going to? How are we going to deal with the fact that the wolf is a clan animal for the Native Americans, and very little hunting of it is expected on reservation land?
Well, and that is certainly that is one of the things that needs to be taken into consideration. The department right now is really walking a tightrope. It may be akin to the Willenda guy going across Niagara Falls here. This may be just as great a feat as that if we can pull this off. It's going to be very, very difficult.
Are we rushing into it? And if we do rush into it, into a wolf hunt in Wisconsin, could there be a lawsuit? Do you expect that to happen?
You know, one can never predict that type of thing. I think there's some caution because when at the current situation, what happened out in Wyoming, I think there's a danger if the thing shuts down completely that there may be some ramifications, that there may be more lost than gained. So I am not aware. And the people I've talked to in the department are not aware of anything any group that's out there looking at challenging the delisting on the federal level. What happens on the state level, we're going to have to see what happens.
Dave, Joe Knight here. Have you heard anything from I know there was some conferencing with the Chippewa Indians, but they were pretty much left out of the loop when the legislature passed this bill. And I know I wrote something about the wolf hunt, and I got a email from Glyphwick saying, hey, you know, we're entitled to, if we choose, to 50% of the harvest, yet no one even gave us a phone call, you know.
Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, I know there was some meeting with the tribes. I actually tried to get them to comment, and so far they're being kind of tight-lipped. But I'm wondering if you've heard from them, if they expect to have a certain portion of the harvest, if they object to the quotas as they stand.
I think that they have made the state, at least the DNR, is certainly under an obligation to consult with them, and I think that they have made their position clear to the department. There has been a fair amount of give and take and that type of thing. So I'm assuming that the department is doing what they can do to do this. You know, you talked about this being a kind of a hurry-up deal, and I'm sitting here thinking about that if I try to cook my venison at too high a temperature and too quickly, it quite often turns out to be unpalatable. So I would have preferred a little more of a slow cooker on this thing and a little more consideration of the science and that type of thing. But that said, the legislature gets to do what the legislature gets to do, and we need to deal with it in the best manner that we can.
Dave, how does the Natural Resources Board deal with the sand mining issue, given the fact that we've had some major spills from time to time? Talking to the DNR people, I know they're really heavily worked handling the applications from sand mining companies, and that's only going to continue to grow. The whole sand mining scene, what is the board doing?
So far, the board has done very little on this. You know, we certainly got the petition for rulemaking on the silica and that type of thing. We haven't really sat down and had a board discussion about this. I expect that in our, I believe our September meeting, we're going to be in the West Central region, and a tour of the frac sand mining areas is slated to be on the schedule. I think there's been some talk about that it's becoming a large enough issue that we probably should be looking at doing some type of an environmental impact, or considering the cumulative impacts of this. And I'm not exactly sure what those cumulative impacts are going to turn out to be. Certainly it has people upset, and you know, I don't think that we are completely sure what the total environmental impacts of this are going to be. So it's something that I think should be taken a look at. You know, we have certainly non-metallic mining, gravel mining type of things, and this pretty well falls under that. That's how it's regulated, but it's a little bit different than your common gravel pit type of operation, and I think that how we look at this and how we regulate this is in the process of evolving right now.
Also on the energy front, and certainly impacting wildlife, especially our fisheries resources, is the way that power producers are looking at the dams on the Mississippi River, a dozen to 14 of them, to get hydropower out of them. Untapped right now, most of them are within the Fish and Wildlife Refuge, the Federal Fish and Wildlife Refuge, and yet DNR folks are deeply involved in this, but they're, once again, strained for staff and money.
Well, that it is, and I will admit to some ignorance on exactly how this would function. You know, I've seen various newspaper articles and that type of thing, but the only comment I would say is the shortage of staff and money seems to be the normal operating situation right now.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to take our final break here on the West Side Outside. When we come back, we're going to talk about Dave Carlson's new book, A Fish Gift and Sketches from Northland Adventures. Dave Klassen, chair of the Natural Resources Board, you're welcome to hang with us. But if you've got to go, we appreciate you for staying with us as long as you did on the program. And also to all the other people out there, if you have any remaining questions, any burning issues that you want to talk about, give us a call. Everything Outdoors here on the West Side Outside. The number is 800-228-5615. That number again is 800-228-5615. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side Outside on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. We've talked this hour about the proposed wolf hunt in Wisconsin, what it might look like, and how many, and just the structure and the quota system that might be used. And we are joined on the phone by Dave Claussen. He is the chair of the Natural Resources Board. We've also got the Outdoor Guys, which includes Dave Carlson, host of Northland Adventures, and Joe Knight. And for the remainder of this hour, we're going to talk about a new book that Dave Carlson wrote. It's called A Fish Gift and Sketches from Northland Adventures. And if you have any questions about maybe where to get the book, or if you have any remaining lingering thoughts and or comments on the wolf hunt or lead shot or sand mining, give us a call, 800-228-5615. That number again is 800-228-5615. So, Dave Carlson, I got to ask you, what possessed you to come up with a third book? I mean, I can only imagine it's quite a feat doing one, but let alone three.
I'm asked that question a lot. What possessed me to do it? Because especially after I wrote the second one, I've written three, as you said. I sat down one evening and tallied all of the money and hours and time I had invested in that book, and then the number I had sold, and it came out to a profit in the that figured out at 17 cents an hour. Mm. So there's not a lot of money in this stuff. Joe's written a book, too, and he knows that, too.
I didn't make that kind of a killing.
No, it's you do it for the love of writing and the love of sharing stories, and that's what I've tried to do here is the first part of the book, A Fish Gift, if you will, is a short novel, fiction, and it spells out the one man's struggle to survive in a kind of a tense situation in his home waters and how life flashes by, and he reflects on some of those things and how they've affected him. And the second part of the book is drawn from our program, Northland Adventures, or at least it has some roots there, about people and things we've tackled on those and on that program. And, you know, I started writing this book. In fact, I remember I was visiting with Chris Wood of the Trout Unlimited's National Executive Director, and one of the people also attending that meeting just a few days ago was Mike Dombeck, who used to be the head of the Forest Service and also the Bureau of Land Management. And I was out fishing with Mike after he left the Forest Service, leaving the Clinton administration, and we were fishing on the Wisconsin River, and Mike was telling me about a new book he had written on the history of conservation matters. And unfortunately, I've never read it, but I said, Mike, I'm writing one too. Oh, yeah, what is that? And I said, A Fish Gift. And he looked at me with a puzzled expression on his face and wanted to know, you know, just where it was going. And I said, I don't know yet. And that was like 7 or 8 years ago we floated there. But the book is, yeah, it pieces together some events that might reflect on what has happened to me or the lifestyle I've had and been able to enjoy. And but, you know, when you write things like this, it's like a painter or a sculptor. You take little bits of positive things from your life and other people's lives and throw them together, and they become a collaborative mix, if you will. And one person who's read it said to me that the goal of every fiction writer is to try to come up with one true story. And he said, I think you've come pretty darn close.
Yeah, I have to admit, when I was reading it, I couldn't help it but you know, think that, well, this sounds familiar. This sounds like somebody I know, this main character. But I really enjoyed it, and it really took me for a ride. You know, there was some pretty touching
points. We should maybe say the main character is a outdoor TV journalist.
Yes, yes.
Donley McCurdy.
Donley McCurdy. And yes.
Who has two daughters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds a little familiar, like to someone we know and love.
Well, but, thank you.
But I really enjoyed it. What did you think of it, Joe Knight?
I liked it. I thought I saw, in both parts, I thought I saw a lot of familiar things. I think there's a lot autobiographical in the novella that it starts out with. I the Home River, he in the start, not to give it away, but the main character gets into a predicament early in the story, and the rest of the story is a series of flashbacks on his life. And I thought that the creek where he got into his predicament sounded a little bit like Duncan Creek to me. Well, maybe with a little more barbed wire than I see there.
You've seen the barbed wire too, huh? No, it's you know, it could be Duncan, it could be a lot of streams. And you know, when I wrote it and looked at it and had some really good help editing it, I kept thinking, I've got to somehow make this appealing to the people who know nothing about my background, know nothing about places I've fished, and as well as those who will go along with me and give me a little leniency in telling a story that, once again, has some positives that are pulled from a lot of people's lives, and some happy things, some very happy things, and some not so happy. Mm-hmm. But it's just meant to be a story. And
real people? I thought there were a lot of real people. Their names have been changed to protect the innocent.
It's something like that. Could be, Joe.
you're
being kind to me.
Your cameraman, I thought, was kind of a mix of the late Tom Lawine and maybe your current sidekick, Dave Roll.
I don't know. It could be. You're being kind, though.
I kind of saw there was some symbolism in there, and I got to ask, I've never really reviewed a book on the air before, so I don't know how to tread lightly here and not give too much away, but there's this black wolf that keeps appearing in the story. Is there any symbolism, any deep meaning there?
You know, there is. Wolves, we've talked about it, obviously. They're very much debated critters, and they're mystical critters, mm-hmm. mythical critters. Coming in and out, as that wolf did in that story for this individual, I think... is a way for us to measure our own strengths and our own fears, and how we, you know, we at times beg for some mercy from critters, mm-hmm. and without knowing it, yet feel a kinship to them too. I think that's kind of what this person goes through. The wolf isn't the only thing that appears and so forth, but it is a major one, and they're controversial, and you throw that into the mix, it catches people's attention and maybe gets them thinking about their own predicaments in life and how they deal with things. I should mention the books, and you know,
yeah. Well, where do we get
available?
It?
It's available at Shields in Eau Claire, and the local store, part of Volume One downtown Eau Claire. Mm-hmm. Their new store, by the way, is very nice. Crossroads Bookstore downtown, and then you know I want to, it'll eventually, it only came out about a month ago. I want to get it into a lot of bookstores around the Midwest. But I'm also big on dropping it off at sports shops, even though women are the ones who tend to buy 80% of the books. Hmm. I've got it in Bill's Sports up in Chippewa Falls, Chautauqua Rod and Gun in Chautauqua, Bear Paw up in Rice Lake, Anglers All in Ashland, and Hayward Fly Fishing up in Hayward. And the Northwind Book and Fiber Store in Spooner, and Paragis up in Ely, Minnesota, too, has carried some. And I want to get it in some other stores like that where outdoors people tend to hang out. And I love sports shops. I like Shields and Gander Mountain and some of these places that are high-tech, you know, big shopping sprees places. But I love going into the small sports shops, the ones that have always been the backbone of the outdoors mm-hmm. activity, and they smell good, they feel good, and they talk good.
They great talk good, yeah. You walk in, you end up walking out 30 minutes later.
Absolutely, so stop in those places as well.
Another thing that I noticed was that it wasn't a battle between the old and the new ways, but there was definitely a contrast of the old ways before electronic communications, And at one point there was a part that where the main character was speaking with a lodge owner, was a little ashamed because he had a cell phone strapped to his belt.
Right.
I thought that was kind of an interesting. Could you explain?
Well, we all fall into that pit or trap with the gadgetry. Leopold talked about it many years ago, and gadgets can consume you, and certainly there are no end to them in this world today. We've got everything from our phones, which are truly smartphones. They can provide a lot of information instantaneously and communication instantaneously. And I've got a guide friend up in the Boundary Waters who actually said to me, and I was a little surprised, he was hoping that they do erect a controversial tower that is being bandied about up there. It's in court right now, I believe. And because he would like to, when he is out there with clients, kind of step aside. And he's been doing this now for nearly 30 years, this business, but only late. He said, I could do business out in the woods when he's trapping, when he's with clients, whatever. And he misses some of that. And he feels that in his case, the tower wouldn't be too intrusive. But, yeah, we do tend to drag things in there. And in some ways, you go back to these places that you've been before, and they're a little smudged now with the things that we haul in. And I guess I've kept my old boat and several old boats. I've kept some of my old equipment, that others ridicule me for still using. Mm-hmm. But, in fact, just today I was asked to come down to the bass fishing tournament at La Crosse and bring my boat down there. And the reporter wanted to lay my boat next to one of those fast and furious trackers and rangers and so forth and talk about the differences. Well, the main difference is the price tag.
Not $50,000, $60,000.
Not even close. But, Joe, you know that.
A little easier to haul, too, than the
You know how roughing it is up in the big woods and so forth, and the Canadian trips, and even around here, sticking with the basics. You get enjoyment out of that, don't you?
I tend to leave my cell phone. One thing they have now that was when I started doing canoe trips, they did not have a satellite phone, which are a mixed blessing. It's good if you get into trouble and you're 100 miles from anywhere. But one saving grace that people won't use it too much is they have batteries that you don't want to wear out before the week-long trip. And they're also very expensive, so satellite time. Right. So when we've taken it, we've just made call halfway, call the outfitter and say, hey, we're still alive and we're such and such a place.
Every day you read about extremes. I couldn't believe last week, I think it was in the Pioneer Press, about a guy who's developed a technique for calling fish in. Not with scent either, but actual sounds, making sounds that fish imitate when they're feeding, when they're breeding. Can you imagine that, Joe, when they're spawning? and he was marketing this. Dave Orrick wrote it up, in the paper, and a Minnesota fisherman, entrepreneur, for sure.
Now, would that go in the turkey call department? Or
I don't know where it would go. Fish call. Can you imagine that?
Of course, there's more to this book than the novella, but I really enjoyed the novella. First of all, you had a Hunter Thompson quote in there that Hunter Thompson is one of my favorite writers of all times. Just the way he would, it was so blunt and in your face about stuff, but a little almost seemed like a bit of a rebuke against the mass media and TV in particular.
Sure. I agree. This person in the book, not bitterly, but just certainly stood up, I should say, and pointed to those things where mass communicators, the mass communications industry, be it newspapers, TV, radio, whatever, they do use and they do swallow up people.
They grind you right up.
They grind you right up. And I spoke about that in there too. I think the job is, like one of the people, and it says to the main character, don't make too much of it. Don't make too much of it. Just go about what you've got to do and get it done. And in his case, that was a bit of survival advice for the young the elderly person in the book.
I really enjoyed it. And as far as Joe Knight, I'll ask you, as far as the sketches from Northland Adventures, any favorites of yours?
I like the one, I forget what it was called, it was about an old tree in yeah. Dave's yard.
Yes, yes.
This is the nonfiction part.
Right.
As far as nonfiction as outdoor stories get. Where he's splitting
planting
the wood
a
and
new
he's,
life, yeah.
he's kind of reminiscing about when his daughters were young and they played in it. And
planting a new history.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And then the new history, though, was that he, in the sunlight that was now let in by the falling of this big tree, he started a prairie, an urban prairie. So mm-hmm. that was a nice.
And I got a kick out of the rock piles, just the frustration of just the different situations. Where was that? Was that?
That was actually in South Dakota.
Okay.
No, I take that back. North Dakota, I guess. Mm-hmm. Plenty in both places. Plenty in Wisconsin too.
Oh yeah. Piles. Yeah, you know, I never really thought of them, but you see them if you're going down the road. Just they've been there for so long.
These are piles made from clearing farm fields that, mm-hmm. that as they become overgrown with weeds, actually are good wildlife havens.
Right,
they are.
Right.
Yeah, the little critters on up.
Well, once more, Dave, where do we get this thing?
In Eau Claire, Shields, the local store, and Crossroads Bookstore. And then some sport shops around the area, Bill's at Chippewa, Shatec Rod and Gun, Bear Pond, Rice Lake, Anglers Hall up in Ashland, and Hayward Fly Fishing.
All right. Well, it was a very good read, I enjoyed it. And
thank you very much.
Thanks to my guests, Dave Claussen, Dave Carlson, and Joe Knight. A very good discussion this evening. That's our time. I'd also like to thank Team Westside, including Mort Cypress, Joey Dietrich, Ellen Zemereep, and Dean Kallenbeck. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for listening. We'll chat again next week.